So this is still, this idiom is still deep, and it's only brought out when it's politically convenient, maybe. But I would say, you get this argument sometimes that, well, if states could leave, counties could leave, and I just think it's not the greatest comparison. And there are still states right now considering leaving, right? I mean, the Second Vermont Republic, I mean, Texas probably love to leave. The Reconquista of the Southwest of the United States, as the participants in it call it, right? I mean, so it's not as if this is 150 years ago and old, dusty stuff, right? So it may happen 20 years or something.
Elaine, did you have a comment as well?
Just briefly, that if the argument for secession works, I think it works better for individuals than for states. This is not an historical or a legal argument, and it would be interesting to see how that might play out. But if one goes back to, for example, the Declaration of Independence and think that's a living document and that the truths in that still hold good, then insofar as government becomes tyrannical, then one would hope that there would be opportunities to secede.
Okay, Mark, really quick.
Let me show you how complicated your question is from a historical point of view. During the Civil War, the western counties of Virginia seceded. The opponents of secession supported it. The enemies of secession opposed it, but you get West Virginia. So there you go. Sort that out if you can. And that actually happened. That's not theoretical. That's historical.
Jen, and then to the next question.
So I'd like to say that I think that Elaine is on to something here. But beyond that, I want to draw our attention to the idea that we're talking about a social contract. And very few contracts, actually zero contracts that we recognize now are punishable by war if you breach it. There's generally some sort of mechanism that you have to pay something if you breach a contract in some sort. We can't even put people in prison very much now for breaching contracts. So basically, it's a fine. We don't even have debtors' prison anymore, which is terrible. But the point being that it seems that if we're talking about the right to secede, what we really should be talking about in terms of the contract is the punishment for secession or the punishment for breaching the contract, right? Is it death? Is that an appropriate punishment, or is there some other way to go about adjudicating this?
I know everybody wants in on the debtor prison question, but we're going to go back to the audience, please.
Hi, Stephen Pett, Hamilton College. I have a similar question to the one that was just posed. Was there a particular threshold that needed to be met in order to make secession justifiable? And could any state at any time simply, by virtue of calling a state convention, secede for any reason?
I feel terrified to take the mic. Right? Yeah. I'm going to be the spokesperson for secession or something. On tape, right? I don't know. Mark, correct me if I'm wrong. As far as I know, the section that considered secession the most was New England, right? Like 1806, 1807, 1812. I mean, over and over and over, they're like, we're going to leave. They won't send troops, right, to the war. And then they get down there and they're like, get out of here. You want to leave? Go. They're like, oh, okay. We'll stay. Right? So, it's not as if other people weren't thinking about this, right? And it seemed to be just almost for like we're pissed off and we'll leave and take our ball and go home. And it did not seem to, for the self-understanding of the participants, require such weighty issues as, are we being oppressed in the ultimate sense, or is slavery okay? Or, as far as whether that's a right or not, I don't know. But it seemed like that's how they understood themselves. Right? Where the threshold is, I don't know. It seems like it's pretty low. You can just leave, right? Let's get divorced.
But evidently not. Not after the Civil War.
Yes, Texas v. White. That's right. It's not okay. So, yeah.
Philip Schulman, Hamilton College. Henry Ward Beecher said liberty is the soul's right to breathe. And it's my contention that the South thought they were being choked by the federal government. But in turn, they were doing that to the individual. So my question is there such a fine line between the contract entered between the individual and state and that the state enters with a federal government that allows for secession to be okay.
Go ahead, Jen.
I'd like to not to say not answer your question, but use this question to bring up something that I've been sort of thinking about this entire time. So I think the issue of slavery is biasing the way that we think of this, because all of us here understand that there was a misappropriation of state power over individuals in that society, right? And so we have relegated the South to a position of wrong, and therefore we're talking about their secession as you know, in that context. But I want to think for a moment, what if they had won the vote? And the North then was in the position of having to remain in a society that supported slavery and had decided instead of doing that to secede. Would we be having this discussion? Would it have the same light as it does now if, in fact, the people who were seceding were the people that we feel are in the right?
And even perhaps maybe an even better question is, would we think that slavery was the right form and that anti-slavery was wrong? Because make no mistake, the people in the South had wicked good arguments about why slavery was a good thing, especially when compared, if you look at the writings in the 1840s, I mean, these guys are writing at the same time that people like Marx and Engels are, and they're looking at the same outcome of capitalism where you have children going into mines, and the Southern opinion was, hey, at least we don't send our kids out in the field until they're 12, and when they get old, we give them lighter duty. What do? Up North, you guys, you throw them into the gutter. Right, you have disposable people. We actually care. We're warm. We're happy. We're a family. And besides, slavery is everywhere, and slavery is in the Bible. So there you go. So you tell me, how do you justify it? All I'm saying is that we might the question might have been answered very, very differently. And I'd also add that the people who actually thought that slavery was evil in the North were in the minority. You know, I mean, it wasn't that they thought that it was bad to enslave people. Most people in the North weren't abolitionists. Most people in the North just didn't want the competition, right? I mean, it was an economic argument, much, much more so for most of these guys than it was an argument to, you know, kindness or decency. Dollars are king. Mark.
I just want to speak to the question, sort of. Jen's comment raises, I think, an important point. Secession is for losers. And I mean that not as facetiously as it sounds. What I mean is, had, as Jen suggested, had the North lost the political argument, they might have contemplated secession. But Southerners felt that they were losing their grip on their ability to control the government. And for a long time, I mean, why the regime survived is because the slaveholders of the South had were a powerful presence in the national government in the way that most slaveholding classes elsewhere were not. They could shape policies, they could shape laws, they could protect themselves. When they believed they were losing their power to do so, and that the future looked bleak, grim, and enslavement for themselves to the northern faction that had seized control of the government, they opted to leave.
And also there's an economic argument there as well, how much capital was actually invested mm-hmm. in these slaves sure. that there's so many people in the North were trying to make invaluable. It was like a takings. Yeah, Pamela.
Well, just a little addendum onto what Mark said. This is maybe in the form of a question, but is it not the case that prior to Lincoln being elected president, the South, far from imagining they had to secede, was really feeling its oats? I mean, after all, they had a president in their pocket, they had a chief justice of the Supreme Court in their pocket, and they had, in a sense, the way Lincoln seemed to see things, a fairly clear line to look at the possibility of spreading slavery in every territory and ultimately in states and then in all the new places that they imagined we would conquer, such as Cuba or, you know, other such places, places in the Caribbean. And so it's hard. Yes, secession looks like it was the choice for losers, But that, to me, only brings up again, I know that I am speaking from, you know, the normal, ordinary distaste for this
peculiar institution.
Not for the Constitution.
Peculiar institution.
Oh, this peculiar institution. Right. Yeah, of course. I think the Constitution is, you know, a glorious liberty document. But I'm just wondering whether we can, in our own historical experience, separate the constitutional issue of secession. I mean, this is something that Genovese wonderfully brings up from the issue of slavery without appearing to the world to be morally obtuse.
Okay, just a really quick one. A
manual for managing slaves in the Roman Republic looked awfully like a contemporary management, good management manual. That said, it doesn't mean that the slaves were necessarily well treated. Think of Uncle Tom's Cabin. It enabled families to be split apart forcibly. And even if that were not the case, liberty trumps welfare.
Are you talking about Cato the Elder? That the slave document?
About that time.
Yeah.
Yes, hi. My name is Ben Sweat. I'm from Hamilton College. And I had a question that kind of took this discussion of Southern conservatism out of antebellum and Civil War era. And I was wondering why, if the South had such a tradition of individual or personal liberty and dispersed government and decentralized government, why the South largely voted as a solid voting bloc for the Democratic Party until the 1960s, even though the Democratic Party was the one who championed and eventually enacted the New Deal, which was a huge increase of the central government's power. And I was just wondering if there are any facets of Southern conservatism or the tradition of Southern conservatism that would explain this.
Or was it just because they weren't Republicans? Seriously, I mean, because they weren't Republicans. They were so pissed off about the Civil War that they wouldn't vote for the Republicans until Johnson finally divorced them with the Civil Rights Act. I mean, that was it. So I don't think that there was anything particular in the Democratic Party that the Southern Democrats really loved as a party.
Some of Roosevelt's chief opposition came from within the Southern Democratic Party. So, yeah, I think that's right.
Marta Johnson from Hamilton College. I'm going to want to kind of shift gears a little and go back to earlier in the discussion when it was briefly talked about that the federal government and the Constitution was really put in place because the government that they had wasn't strong enough to protect their rights. But it was also brought up that, you know, within 10 years or so, you had the Alien and Sedition Acts. So my question is a government strong enough to protect individual rights? I guess, is there a correct size of government that it can protect individual rights without being strong enough to infringe on them? Or is it going to come down to a government that's strong enough to protect individual rights is going to always be strong enough to infringe on them, and it just has to act responsibly?
Go ahead.
I think I would take the latter view insofar as it's a difficult question. In the founders' understanding themselves, in terms of what portion of power does government need to secure the individual's rights well. That's not something that's so clear when you get down to writing the document and allotting those powers. And there is always the problem that Madison's dictum that men are not angels, that every power that's given to government that is needed for legitimate purposes is always subject to abuse. There are ways of trying to minimize that danger. But until you figure out some way of turning men into angels, you can't banish the problem altogether.
Professor Crane.
Yeah, that's a great and very difficult question. And I would answer in the following way, because I'm the one who's been sort of defending the idea of a strong but limited government, and that can easily be confused with a strong and expansive government. And I would like to make a very important distinction between the two. And the way in which I would make the distinction is by drawing a distinction between two understandings of rights. The original meaning of the word rights was protections and immunities from the arbitrary power of the state. Over the course of about 150 years, rights have come to mean entitlements from the states. These are two huge differences in the way in which we conceive of rights. If you understand rights to be protections and immunities, you need a fairly strong government, you know, to support those rights and prevent society from degenerating into anarchy and so on. But you can still understand government to be strong but limited because the rights you're protecting are essentially protections and immunities from the power of the state. But if rights come to mean entitlements, which it does during the Progressive Era, some people think under the influence of Hegel, the German philosopher who kind of started conceiving of liberty as liberty through the state rather than liberty from the state, rights become entitlements. And what are entitlements? Entitlements are claims of benefits from the state rather than protections and immunities, and obviously that leads you to strong and expansive government. So I think the important thing is to work out that the true meaning of rights, which I actually think is the first meaning, the original meaning, rights as protections and immunities rather than entitlement. And on those grounds, you can argue for a strong but limited government rather than a strong but expansive government. You follow that?
Oh. I think just to add on to what Bob is saying is that it's really a matter of whether or not there are effective constraints on where government is able to practice its power, use its power, right? And I think he's making the argument that having a social concept of rights as negative liberties acts as such a constraint. I'm not so sure that we can really use a conception of rights as our main form of constraint on government power. I don't think that ever really has a chance of working, mainly because of the fact that people become complacent when it does work, right? So if we're successful and government is limited and we prosper, then people tend to, lose focus on what got us there, right? So even if that conception of rights was the successful constraint of government, it's not working anymore in that sense. And I'm not sure it's because the conception of rights changed for everyone. I think it's more that we got rich enough that we started to think that, oh, maybe we should do more things for people instead of having just this negative conception of rights. I think that it's possible that the conception changed, but that was a result of something as opposed to the cause of something.
Can I reply to that?
No, okay.
I mean, I understand the argument you're making all along that somehow we want government to do more because government can now do more, and it's sort of because it's there, let's use it. But I think there's something much more powerful going on, and that is people now conceive of rights in a completely different way than they originally did. And it's not just because we can do more, it's because they actually think they're entitled to more, based on some expansive notion of what a human being deserves simply by virtue of being a human being. And so you have to ask yourself, where does that come from? Where does that expanded notion of rights come from? And I think it comes from a certain kind of influence of a certain kind of German idealism on the progressive movement, that it's not just a matter of what we can do, but what we ought to do if we conceive of a human being as being entitled to certain things. And that will lead us to our discussion of social justice, I think, tomorrow morning.
Good. So just stop right there. Yeah. We're almost out of time. I want to try and get one more question in.
Professor Malvasi, you suggested at the beginning of this session that the North and the South originally believed that they were ratifying different documents. And indeed, we can see that the two primary writers of the Federalist also, to some extent, believed that they were defending a different document. Given that, what is the value, or is it possible to talk about an original meaning of the Constitution?
Thank you. I think if you pluralize it, yes, original meanings. But people had different, again, if you go to the debates and you read the state debates, people aren't talking about the same document. They think it means different things. They think it leads to a different conception of government. I mean, not entirely different. I mean, there are overlaps and similarities, obviously. But I think if you get deeply into the state debates on the Constitution, no, there's not one single unitary meaning. I can't find it. Maybe a constitutional scholar, which I am decidedly not, can do so, but I can't find it. I find significant and important differences that lead to problems like secession, like civil war down the road.
Okay, let's leave it there for today. Okay, we've got transportation for the conferees to the AHI at 6:10. There's a bus that will be leaving from the circle right outside the front desk. And for the students going back to Hamilton, there's also a bus that should be arriving, I think, in the same place, going at the same time. So thanks very much. We'll see you tomorrow.